Henry Bolton is standing on the edge of a cliff face. The newly elected UKIP leader inherits a party in somewhat of an identity crisis. His nearest rival in the recent leadership election, Anne-Marie Waters, secured 21% of the vote. She is an anti-Sharia campaigner who calls Islam, quote, evil. Mr. Bolton warned the party risks becoming the, and I quote again, UK Nazi party if it plumped for the wrong candidate. Miss Waters has vigorously denied the claim. But if it's the case, what does that make 21% of the new leader's party? Indeed, a poll by YouGov indicates that half of British people and 60% of Conservatives believe that Islam poses a serious threat to Western civilization. In the general election in June, UKIP's vote collapsed, from 12.6% in 2015 to 1.8% as its moderate supporters flocked to the Conservatives, who have adopted a stance favourable to leaving the EU since the referendum. Interestingly, the BNP's vote share has undergone a similar drubbing, from 1.9% in 2010, its best electoral showing, to a statistical 0%, 4,642 meagre votes. You do the maths. So Mr. Bolton faces a fascinating challenge, needing to realign and strategise a party on the brink of electoral irrelevance when it loses its MEPs in 2019. Rather him than me. He spoke to me about becoming the pro-Brexit opposition, UKIP's intention to launch a positive future for a United Kingdom outside of the EU, and, obviously, how he would vote if the referendum was rerun tomorrow.
Hello.
Hi, Henry. How are you?
Hi. Yeah, I'm well, thank you.
Henry, we've voted to leave the EU. We've Brexited. What's the point of UKIP?
We haven't Brexited at all. We haven't left the European Union at all. Absolutely nothing has happened in that regard. We've started discussing a bit of legislation. Nothing's agreed in negotiations. No planning or preparation has taken place. We've got a Chancellor who doesn't want to fund planning or preparation. We've got a Prime Minister who says that she won't say how she would vote if there was another referendum. And we've got her deputy saying that it would have been better if the UK had voted to remain. We're not moving towards Brexit at all.
Fair enough.
You know, UKIP's sort of prime task is to make sure that we get out of the European Union. However, it's not just about that. It's about, as I said to somebody earlier today, it's about through Brexit and beyond. It's about leaving the European Union, but setting up this country for success afterwards in a whole range of areas, security, trade, the whole raft of policy areas have to be addressed, and we need to get all our policies in place to make sure that happens. We've got a government that's not doing it.
Absolutely, and I'm very much like to revisit security later on. You're somewhat of an expert in the field, but just sticking with news today for the time being, the EU has told Britain it will make no concessions to break, and I quote, the disturbing deadlock in negotiations. At what point does the UK walk away from the negotiations? When do we say no deal?
Well, now. We need to be preparing right now for that option. We should have been starting to prepare for that the day after the referendum, but we didn't. We put nothing in place. So, what we're saying, really, what I believe is happening in Whitehall is that, quite simply, they're hoping it's all going to be all right on the night. it's a bit of a risk to take. It's negligence. We need to be ready to pull out at any point. One of the things that I suspect is going through the minds of people in Brussels and some of the EU member state capitals is that, if there is no deal because the Brits won't bow to what they want, then they're watching us. They know that we're not preparing for anything. So we leave in March 2019. We've prepared nothing, and it's going to be a car crash. So and then they get exactly the signal that they want to the other EU member states, which is, you know what, you don't want to be leaving the EU. You don't want to go down that route. And at the same time, then they can come back to us 6 months later and offer us, this is what they'll be thinking, offer us some sort of deal, which they hope that we will be desperate to take and we will be then staying because we'll be in a transition period or whatever we'll be in, some sort of odd limbo, and the government will be totally lost as they are now.
Yeah, sure. In that instance, let's say right now we go, you know what, it's over, no deal, we're off. What happens on the Irish border? If we're not in the single market and customs union, a hard border goes up in Armagh and the Good Friday Agreement collapses.
Right. And you know who would be to blame for that? The European Union, the European Commission. The only obstacle to solving that problem is the fact that the European Commission want a secure external border for the European Union. They're the ones that want a border between North and South. And it's certainly not the British government, certainly not the Irish government. It's the European Commission. That is the only entity that is arguing for that for border controls to be there. And what they have said is, we want border controls there. Now, you tell us how you can have border controls but not have them. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
They've set the thing up, and somehow the British media has allowed this to happen, whereby the European Commission has basically put the government in a no-win situation. It's not us asking for the border, it's them.
They're being deliberately obstructive.
They are. Well, I mean, what they're doing is they're being entirely inflexible. They're not looking at any solutions because they do have a responsibility to secure the EU's external borders.
Yeah.
And that will be an EU external border. The problem is that, of course, they don't pay as much attention to the EU's external borders in other places.
You'll definitely get the chance to speak about that, don't you worry.
Right.
In the same eventuality, though, what happens in the no-deal scenario? What happens to the 3.2 million EU citizens living in the UK? Are they welcome to stay, carte blanche?
Yeah, there's two things there. It's an interesting situation where we've had the Prime Minister and we've had Amber Rudd both say almost exactly the same thing as each other. We are going to put an end to the freedom of movement for EU citizens after we leave the European Union, meaning March 2019. And then in the next sentence, a separate sentence, they say we are going to require EU citizens to register their presence here. You know, as a Brit, when I was working in Vienna, I had to register there. When I was a Brit working for the European Union in Brussels, I had to register there. And indeed, the police knock on your door to make sure you're living where you say you're living.
Mm.
Okay, there is no, getting people to register that is in no way seen by the European Union. Oh, it is in our case, and they've told us it's unacceptable now. But for every other country, if you're a Brit and you want to go and live abroad, it's acceptable there. They're just making things bloody difficult for us. Now, EU citizens who are living and working here now, absolutely. I mean, of course they're welcome. We're not going to be kicking any of them out so long as they don't commit any violations of the law, so long as indeed they are registered. They're working and they're contributing. That's fine.
So let's say you make it to number 10. And mm-hmm. you're fronting these negotiations. It seems awfully complex. Have you got the grit for this? What are your credentials to deal with this situation?
Well, first of all, the negotiations are difficult for two reasons. One is that the European Union is, well, even Barnier is given his remit by the other 27. He himself is very limited in what he can actually negotiate. He's sort of caught in the middle. So the Brits say something, then he has to figure out whether that's within his remit. If not, then does he go back to the member states, the other 27 member states, and work with them? It's a difficult thing. So they're very inflexible. But the other thing that's important to note is that our own government is not negotiating properly. It's produced a number of position papers, which, because I've got a really sad life, I read. they actually contain nothing but sort of hot air, really. In the security treaty position paper that was submitted, it's effectively saying, look, cooperation has been quite useful. We think it's useful anyway. We think you think it's useful. We think that we could probably agree that we both think it's useful and that probably going forward we'd like to continue cooperating.
Mm.
Now, you know, that's no way to negotiate. That's more sort of almost a briefing paper, a fairly weak briefing paper for a minister. What we actually need to be doing is drafting up a if we want a security treaty, which is another topic, but if we want one, if the government thinks we want one, right, we draft one, send it across to Brussels and say, right, have a look at this. We'll be over in a week. Get your red pen out. No. Get coffee on. We're going to go through this line by line. And we're not going to leave until we've actually got a document that we think is mutually acceptable. But at the moment, we've put nothing concrete on the table. The government's just putting vacuous position papers on the table. And
I've negotiated
for the European Union. And, you know, they'll be looking at this. And actually, they've got a point. The British government is saying and offering nothing concrete at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be interested to hear your view if we could go completely domestic for a moment and forget about the EU.
Right.
PTSD is on a dramatic rise among our military personnel. You served in Helmand.
Yeah.
Is this an issue for the MOD, or should society itself be examining its treatment of veterans?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Just to say, I served in Helmand, but in a civilian capacity, although I was commanding certain lines of operations, that they were the civilian governance, rule of law, you know, that kind of thing. So I was working alongside as a partner to the commander of the United States Marine Corps. So
yeah.
I don't want people to be confused and
think
I was serving
there
in uniform. But yeah, I was there for 2.5 years. I saw, and experienced many things, as did many of the US Marine Corps and British troops. I was with the Marine Corps, as I say, not the Brits, but... yeah, it's a massive problem. And you know what, though? I think we've, in some ways, social media and communications make it worse. And actually, probably about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a very good item in The Lancet medical journal where they'd been analysing this. And actually, a lot of the PTSD suffered by servicemen and women, had not necessarily, hadn't occurred because of a direct exposure to a traumatic event. But for example, people working in the rear areas, listening to things happening on the radio and being unable to help. And there's also an interesting phenomenon of people being able to Skype from certain locations, certain bases, Skype or even telephone family. They're in the middle of this situation. They get family at home are suffering the sort of day-to-day sort of problems that we all face. The washing machine stopped working, or the children are sick, or so. And the guy or girl in Helmand can do nothing about it. But so there's the sort of immediacy of the communications, but a total lack of ability to reach out and actually be supportive. And so that puts a lot of pressure on people. And then, of course, they might go straight out on patrol, or they might just come back from patrol, and it just exacerbates them. Now, is it a responsibility for the MOD? Absolutely, the MOD have a responsibility to monitor the mental health of its personnel. And I actually believe that we need to have an ongoing responsibility to monitor that health afterwards, that the MOD does. I've this morning been at an event to try and lobby for the release of the Chennai six former servicemen who were arrested. They were doing maritime security on an American flagged vessel. They were boarded and arrested by Indian authorities. Although they'd broken no law, they're in jail for 4 years. They've been for 4 years in India, in an Indian jail. But the British government has not effectively followed up on that at all. There's been a little bit of, a few words of concern expressed, but nothing concrete. What we tend to do with our veterans is just drop them. You know, really, it's left to the charities and so on to provide support. Then there needs to be far greater follow-up, I believe, of servicemen and women who've been on active service. Make sure they're okay. And it's not just about mental health. It's about housing. It's about jobs and so on. There's a raft of things.
Yeah.
And these poor people are just, you leave. I'm an ex-serviceman. You leave, and the army then doesn't pay you the blindest bit of attention afterwards. Then they're not interested from that point.
The fight carries on at home, if you will.
It does. And then, there's all sorts of things about that transition. And if you've been through stressful things in the military as well, and stressful incidents, then, it makes it all the more difficult to make that transition to civilian life when you leave. And, it's always been a weak area, I felt. So, yeah, I mean, your question, is this a job for the MOD? Yes, of course. But, of course, then it has an impact on the National Health Service as well going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've got a problem with mental health everywhere. It's not treated in the way that it needs to be. It's not regarded as a serious issue. People suffering from not as serious as physical health. It's not given the same attention. And actually, there's a whole stigma around it. People don't want to talk about mental health issues. It takes a lot of courage to do it because they think that they're going to be, you know, they'll lose their job or. You know, particularly if they've got a job that's, you know, for example, a bus driver or a train driver, you know, people are going to say, well, you know, if I say that I've got, you know, mental health problems, then am I going to lose my job over it?
Yeah,
and so that whole, you know, it's a difficult thing to do.
No doubt.
Seek that help.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to steer things back to Brexit now, but that's a fascinating insight. Thank you very much. Yeah. You've described UKIP as the pro-Brexit opposition. Don't you need more than 2% of the vote for that to be the case?
No. I'm not suggesting this is part of the plan at all, but you could have 1% of of the vote and still be the only pro-Brexit opposition. No, look, we made a tactical error by not fielding candidates in all seats for the last general election. Mm-hmm. And we fielded about 50% of the seats, so we lost 50% of the votes. So, you know, immediately we took a hit there. There was no opportunity for people who would have otherwise voted for UKIP to do so. We've obviously lost a lot of, that general election, we lost a lot of support in terms of votes to the Conservatives because Theresa May was saying, look, you know, we are going to get you Brexit and we are the government. We just need your votes to make that, you know, to give us a stronger hand. Well, yeah, okay, thank you very much, Theresa May. So what have you done since then? Absolutely the square root of nothing. So in terms of practical effect. So and we're getting emails and I'm getting messages as well personally from people saying, look, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I voted Tory in the last general election. What a mistake. I'm never going to vote for them again. I thought they were going to deliver. And this is the situation. So, yeah, you know, we can look at the vote at the last general election, but I'd put good money on it that if we had another general election now, we'd be increasing our vote percentage there. And my intention is to bring that right up. My intention is obviously to get bums on green seats in Westminster. Mm. This party's proved that you can have huge influence without necessarily having people in Westminster. Imagine what we could do if we did. And the other thing is, of course, if we'd got proportional representation, then we'd, you know, probably have, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15 seats in Westminster ourselves as well. So,
interesting you talk about electoral reform.
Which I think is an important thing.
Absolutely.
And that's something that I want the party to engage on with a bit more energy.
Yeah, so we'll talk about the Lib Dems then, who you could probably call the anti-Brexit opposition. And, you know, the party who Nick Clegg introduced, well, pushed for the AV referendum, didn't quite get what he wanted in terms of PR. But you stood as a candidate for them. Indeed, you've worked for the EU. It's quite a radical shift along the political spectrum from there to UKIP leader. What inspired that change for you?
Two things. I mean, one is, I mean, people look at it and think that, well, you know, he joined the Lib Dems because he was a Lib Dem, which is a logical assumption to make. But I actually did that because at the time I was mandated by the UN Security Council to help political parties in Kosovo to form themselves, to establish themselves. And that included their internal governance and internal procedures. And at that time, 1999, and in Kosovo there was no internet or anything. The only way I could find out really how all this was done was by joining a political party.
Oh, right.
And so so that's why I joined a party, and I wasn't going to join the Conservatives. I certainly wasn't going to join Labour. So I thought, well, you know what, you know, just, you know, go down the middle. And then I then realised that liberalism had changed its meaning. I'd been taught that liberalism was about, you know, it was classic liberalism, but now it's more, it's moved way down the route of, you know what, everybody can do, or society owes everything to the individual. The individual's got no responsibilities towards society. And that's putting it a little bit sort of in the general sense, but and that appalls me. And then, of course, the increasing sort of passion on the part of the Lib Dems that we should remain in the European Union was a total switch off. Fast forward, I went into Brussels and I became well Eurosceptic, and became passionately an advocate of us getting out as quickly as possible. That was the experience, because the experience I had working actually in the heart of the beast. So, and also in terms of transitioning from one party to another, Churchill was a liberal.
Yeah, fair enough. So you mentioned Kosovo. I understand as well, you also specialised in North African security. And we mentioned earlier the sort of the nature of borders and whether they're hard or soft, depending on where you are in the EU. North Africa is one of the regions acting as a point of departure in the Mediterranean migrant crisis. What do you think the EU could do to resolve that situation?
Could do or will do? It will do nothing. it could have done a great deal. That migrant situation does not start at the southern coast of the Mediterranean, the northern coast of Africa. It starts much deeper into the African continent. It's driven by conflict. It's driven by persecution, prejudice within communities. It's driven by all sorts of things. And of course, it also comes from the Middle East as well. So there's, now there's so it's a movement of people, of course. And what needs to happen is that we need to look at every point along that route and figure out how we can reduce it. Now, in the trade, if you like, you'd call that upstreaming. Mm. You go back up the flow and you look at where you can reduce it and every opportunity that you've got. Now, parts of that are, I would say, that just to throw out some general points, parts of that are people smuggling networks that are absolutely critical to that movement across certain areas, such as the Sahara and parts of the Sahel and the Maghreb. Let's go after them. These people are killing people. There are people who are dying in the desert. They're getting people to Libya or wherever. They're getting on a boat. They're drowning, and they're creating a security threat to us. We should be going after them. I mean, I see them no differently to a terrorist. Let's go in there. Let's kill them.
Yeah, it's up humanitarian the risk. There's crisis, no risk. Yeah.
I mean, it's also a security problem. So, I mean, you know, these are people who are active in crimes that are leading to people dying. They're active in crimes that are leading to a real and present security risk for the whole of the European Union. And including us at the moment in the European Union. So we should be going after them. We should also be putting more pressure on governments to make sure that that corruption is addressed and that law enforcement agencies work appropriately. Now, I'm talking about this huge, huge work, but let's think about where we're not managing it at the moment, are we? And let's fast forward to, let's say, another 35 years from now. 2050, the population of Africa is likely to have doubled. There's no additional resources in Africa to look after those people. Where are they going to go? They're going to come north.
Yeah.
And we're doing nothing whatsoever to deal with that long-term strategic problem because governments are short-term in their vision. So, and it's a hell of a commitment. But so there's all sorts of things. I mean, and I'm a believer, although I was a part of the planning for the EU mission in the Mediterranean, on the periphery of it, I was very unhappy with it from the start because I just thought that it was going to encourage the people smugglers to put people on less and less seaworthy vessels, and that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah.
So it's been counterproductive, and even the sailors see it as a humanitarian task, not as a disruption task.
On that note, talking about the impact, admittedly, a lot of people are dying and they are suffering, but there are migrants, immigrants who are making that crossing and are making it into Europe. In the past, you've referenced areas of the UK that are devoid of Anglo-Saxons and totally dominated by immigrants. Could you name a few of those areas?
Sorry, you broke up. Can you say that again?
Can you hear me okay, yeah?
Yeah, I'm good now.
Okay, brilliant. So in the past, you've referenced areas of the UK that are devoid of Anglo-Saxons and totally dominated by immigrants, migrants. Could you name a few of those areas?
If you look at areas, off the top of my head, I'm going to be frank with you, I'm struggling to actually recall where they are. Mm. But, there are certainly areas where, we're not looking necessarily in this case at Muslim immigrants, but, for example, Roma immigrants from Romania, Bulgaria, who have been housed entirely in particular streets. In my own town, down in Folkestone, we've got entire streets where local authorities in London have paid local landlords, bypassing the local authority, paid local landlords a hefty rent to accommodate people down there, and they're going down, they're going down the street and basically buying up all the rental accommodation. And then you get a dominantly, whatever it might be, Muslim, Polish, whatever, community. You no longer have that mixed community. There's no assimilation there. I think most of us will be able to point to areas in our local towns where we have that.
Mm. So you were quick to point out at the beginning of the podcast, we haven't actually left, but when we do physically leave in 2019, UKIP will obviously cease to have any MEPs. That's a major source of revenue for the party, and without any MEPs, MPs or local councils under your control, how can we expect UKIP to realign strategically from that point forward?
Well, first of all, that's not a major source of funding for the party.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major source of funding for the activities in Brussels, not here.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my tasks now as leader of the party is to ensure that by that time, then we're well established as a dominant political force in British politics.
Mm.
So that's a piece of planning that's just starting now.
Got you.
I'm going to have to interrupt you because I actually need to go on to do something else.
Okay, sure. That's absolutely fine, Henry. One quick question before you go, finally, since it's the question of the hour. If the referendum was held tomorrow, how would you vote?
Unlike Theresa May, I am perfectly happy to tell you that I would vote to take us out of the European Union.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Henry, for your time. I really appreciate it.
All right. No, you're welcome.
Cheers.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Both Henry and myself are on Twitter. I'm at Ollie Dugmore, OLIDUGMORE, or at _ Henry Bolton. And as always, at Brexit Podcast. The Brexit Podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl and Ollie Dugmore, with the theme music by the one and only Kevin MacLeod.